Part 3. So how does each of these writers settle with such confidence on the main problem that afflicts the current moment, as well as their proposed solution to it? In my book, Waking Up, I proffer the term cultural predestination to explain how two different thinkers, in this case, Pelagius and Augustine, who duke it out for control over the fate of the Catholic Church in the 5th century CE, can be reading the same text, in this case the Christian Bible, so contrarily. I believe similar forces operate for these authors. Their respective predestination charted generally by a combination of murky personal and professional predispositions. What Gadamer calls pre-understanding. Cellist Glendinning, for example, is a psychotherapist by training. So she tends to see problems as a function of largely unconscious psychological processes induced by traumatic experiences, both personal, in her case, a childhood riven with incestuous rape, and cultural, the analogous rape of indigenous peoples by the forces of empire. It is only now, in retrospect, that I am beginning to disentangle her two books, which, with all the others, tended to blur into one cosmic conversation pertinent to personal agency. Off the Map, for example, combines autobiography with a close examination, a la cultural studies, of cartography as an instrument of oppression. To the extent that it proposes a solution, it is via a call to resistance and activism in response to imperialism. My Name is Cellus, written earlier, provides a more theorized context for understanding her overall project. Seen through the longest lens, the shift from a transitory hunter-gatherer to a sedentary farming lifestyle inevitably reshaped attitudes toward land and the way we humans occupy it, gradually skewing things toward the current conventions with increasingly deleterious effects from her point of view. The most obvious ways to get back on a good path again, going back in time or returning to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, are not available to us, of course, though the latter may become inevitable if we destroy civilization as we know it via unabated climate change. Why not, then, just give up and wait for our inevitable demise? Well, for one thing, that makes for both a sad life and a bad book. So there must be some other alternatives. One of them is built into the personal narrative component of her argument in Off the Map. Activism right now, where one lives, to influence policy decisions around land rights and land transfer issues. But the one I want to focus on here is more conceptual, derivative from her training, that is, finding ways to get into intimate touch with what she calls our personal primal matrix. Here's how she describes what that is. People have a natural state of being. It is variously known as being integrated, human potential, and merging mind, body, and spirit. Taoist philosophy refers to this state as the balance of yin and yang. To Lakota Indians, it is known as walking in a sacred manner. To the Diné, standing at the center of the world. I call this state of being our primal matrix, the state of a healthy, wholly functioning psyche in full-bodied participation with a healthy, wholly functioning earth. Glendinning covers a lot of multi- and cross-cultural ground here, in the hopes, I imagine, that at least one of these potential sources for a term is familiar to the reader and can serve as a portal for understanding its nature and implications. She goes on. And what is this healthy state? From the perspective of the individual, it is a bodily experience, a perception of the world, and an attitude about being alive that is characterized by openness, attunement, wonder, and a willingness in the here and now to say yes to life. It is a sense of ease with who we are and fulfillment with what we do. So the primal matrix is both body and mind operating in what sounds to me much like the way Keats considers optimal. Unfortunately, her map for achieving this healthy state is almost as vague as his is. Primal matrix-oriented discourse extends tentacles in many different directions, historically and culturally. In mathematical linear programming, for example, where it organizes relationships between primal and dual functions. In analytic psychotherapy, Freudian and especially Jungian approaches. In cognitive behavioral psychology, especially trauma-based therapies. In religious theory, including early modernist Christian feminism and, via the film The Matrix, Gnosticism. In Taoism, and in Native American spiritualism. As you can see above, Glendinning includes most of these, except for the mathematical and Christian, in her terrain. But understanding what it means in existential terms is no simple matter, absent some background in at least one or two of these discourses and or some profound personal experience with transcendental liminal states of being in the world. For example, as soon as I read her definition, I instantly translated it into my own inner parlance, what I now call the kingdom of heaven state of mind I often enter when I walk in the forest. And lately, via various smaller scale meditative techniques I deploy to counter daily anxieties and irritations. The woods walking version of this came first as a mode of personal experience, a deeply felt sense of communion with trees in particular, inner and outer worlds melding into one, before I had any name for it. I've written about this copiously in all of my books as the foundational state for almost everything I think, write, and do now. Here's a passage from my book, Waking Up, that describes one such event. Every walk in this place is emotionally meaningful to me in some way. Soothing, restorative, illuminating, relaxing, thought-provoking. Every now and then, though, one of them is literally ecstatic. In the etymological sense of that word, I am released from myself and enter into a deep sense of communion with everything around me. There are no boundaries between and among us any longer. It is a wonderfully liberating feeling. The phrase that kept repeating in my head today was, I love you. And I couldn't tell whether it was coming from the inside out toward the forest or outside in toward me. They were, in fact, exactly the same thing. This state of mind lasted at its highest level of intensity for about 15 minutes and gradually settled into a more normal kind of grateful peace of mind. I've experienced this state of being from time to time for as long as I can remember, and I've had an assortment of names, or no name at all for it, along the way. It wasn't until I began to study early Christian literature, the New Testament, and especially the Lost Gospels, with an exclusive focus on what Jesus actually said, my personal jam, that I finally chose my preferred moniker, this Kingdom of Heaven trope, that both I and Jesus and many others understand is not out there, either in the remote past or the remote future, but right here and now, available at any instant for anyone when they are willing to accede to the state of uncertainty that transcending one's personal identity in favor of a universal one, a routine existential condition in indigenous cultures, but now so alien to modern cultures, brings into being. While my trope may have a religious ring to it, what I believe is in most of its aspects decidedly heretical in relation to Christian doctrine, as is most of what Jesus actually said in most organized denominations these days. So to me, it is almost entirely absent any conventional theological connotations. Elaine Pagel's book is a good entry point into this particular discourse for conceptualizing what having or inhabiting a primal matrix, she never uses that term, of course, is and feels like. She's an accomplished scholar in religious history as well as an ardent Christian, which inflects her analysis of the Lost Gospels, where Jesus' concept of the kingdom of God, capital K, capital G, as a self-induced state of being, is ubiquitous. My personal favorite among the Lost Gospels is the Gospel of Thomas, about which I wrote in detail in Waking Up. Pagel summarizes it this way. So according to the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus ridiculed those who thought of the kingdom of heaven in literal terms, as if it were a specific place. He says, "If those who lead you say to you, 'Look, the kingdom is in the sky,' then the birds will arrive there before you. If they say, 'It is in the sea,' then the fish will arrive before you. Instead, it is a state of self-discovery. The kingdom is inside of you, and it is outside of you. When you come to yourself, then you will be known, and you will realize that you are the sons of the living Father." The inside-outside dynamic Jesus describes is crucial to the Gnostic understanding of the kingdom, as it is for me. Once the customary, taken-for-granted boundaries between those two dimensions of being begin to blur and then disappear entirely, both merging naturally and intimately, the kingdom, small k for me, is immediately at hand, as in right now, the only place it can ever truly exist. This is a radical departure from the way the synoptic gospelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and ultimately church orthodoxy, define the kingdom, capital K. In remote temporal terms, first the advent of Jesus himself as an historical person, and then a futural moment of harmony and or cataclysm. Glendening also mentions Taoism as a potential touchstone for understanding what the primal matrix is and does, though she doesn't say which features of Taoist thinking are most pertinent besides the reference to yin and yang. One of them, from my point of view at least, is the conception of cosmic creation, and therefore nature, as a feminine process, foundational to the thought of Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. Many of the Lost Gospels share a similar point of view. As Pagels explains, the Apocalypse of Adam tells of a feminine power who wanted to conceive by herself. She came to a high mountain and spent time seated there so that she desired herself alone in order to become androgynous. She fulfilled her desire and became pregnant from her desire. Along the same lines, the followers of Valentinus and Marcus, who were second-century Gnostics, prayed to the mother of the mystical eternal silence and to grace, she who is before all things and has incorruptible wisdom, for insight. And then again, a voice in the trimorphic protonoia cries out, "I am androgynous. I am the womb that gives shape to all." The female figure is either an important or the primary human protagonist, is also a common feature of Gnostic narratives, as in this case, from authoritative teaching, in which the rational soul longs to see with her mind and perceive her kinsman and learn about her root in order that she might receive what is hers, thereby enacting the most essential aspect of Gnostic thinking, self-initiated seeking for the self-knowledge that is the key to entering the kingdom. There are many more such examples in various Gnostic texts, and the analogy to Taoist ideas is unmistakable. Several other contextual sources for Glendening's concept are indigenous and native philosophies, which also tend either partially or sometimes ardently toward matrilineal and feministic power dynamics. It may seem a stretch to transition from such matriarchal paradigms to the dialectical thinking of Marxist and post-Marxist philosophers in the 19th century. Already by then, at least a couple of millennia into the toxically patriarchal cultural systems that characterize Western societies, made even more so by the 4th and 5th century formation of the Catholic Church during the great Gnostic purges, Pagel's historical wheelhouse. But she actually provides a transitional figure for me to get to Bakunin's version of a primal matrix. As she says, many Gnostics, then, would have agreed in principle with Ludwig Feuerbach, the 19th century psychologist who was a prominent influencer for both Marx and Engels, that theology is really anthropology. For Gnostics, exploring the psyche became explicitly what it is for many people today implicitly, a religious quest. Some who seek their own interior direction, like the radical Gnostics, reject religious institutions as a hindrance to their progress. And she says further, some Gnostic Christians went so far as to claim that humanity created God, and so from its own inner potential, discovered for itself the revelation of the truth. Bakunin obviously believes the first part of that statement. It is just with the effects of that process of invention that he takes issue. While Feuerbach argues that if man is to find contentment in God, he must find himself in God. Bakunin might say that if man is to find contentment in history, he must find himself in collective relationships with others. The God part, from his point of view, no matter the best intentions of the practitioner, inevitably ends up creating a cohort of human God substitutes as overseers who enslave the masses. To the extent that Bakunin has something akin to a primal matrix or kingdom of heaven in his system, I'd have to say it is in his concept of liberty, capital L, which weaves in and out of his critique as a heroic prime mover toward what he calls the real emancipation of the proletariat. As he says, the first word of this emancipation can be none other than liberty. Not that political bourgeois liberty so much approved and recommended as the preliminary object of conquest by Marx and his adherents, but the great human liberty which, destroying all the dogmatic, metaphysical, political and juridical fetters by which everybody today is loaded down, will give to everybody, collectives as well as individuals, full autonomy in their activities and their development, delivered once and for all from all the inspectors, directors, and guardians. This is his utopia, historically possible if approached via the right path. He goes on, the second word of this emancipation is solidarity. Not the Marxian solidarity from above, downwards, by some government or other, either by ruse or force, on the masses of the people, but that solidarity which is on the contrary, the confirmation and the realization of every liberty, having its origin not in any political law whatsoever, but in the inherent collective nature of man. That's a grand vision, the inherent collective nature of man, a kingdom come in its own right. In Marx's system, the dictatorship of the proletariat is a vague sort of utopia with which the dialectic of history will ultimately culminate. For Bakunin, a collective anarchism, an interesting paradox in his own right, can bring that about right now. The specific sort of freedom being described here, via collectivity, is different from the Gnostic version, which arises from individual enterprise and strives for transcendence from both cultural binaries and externally imposed authority. Nor is it identical with Glendinning's primal matrix, which begins with self-inquiry and strives to exceed individual identity in the service of others, yes, but even more so, of the natural world, a figurative ground that is absent in Bakunin. What he does share with both of them, times 10, is a deep distrust of any of the vicious fictions used by established order, an order which has profited from all religious, metaphysical, political, juridical, economical, and social infamies of all times to brutalize and enslave the world. While Bakunin doesn't refer to liberty as she, the term has, quite often, taken on a feminine aspect in Western thinking. The Statue of Liberty, for example, a feminine icon commemorating the friendship between the United States and France, both of which elevate liberty to a nearly transcendent status, was, by coincidence, erected not long after Bakunin's death in 1876. As was the case above, the book most difficult to coordinate with the others in this regard is Ha Jin's account of Li Bai's life. I'm quite sure it does. I just have no idea yet how. So I'll do what I normally do in situations of irresolution like this. I'll start to write and follow the path the writing opens. I think I'll begin with one of the ongoing questions I had in the back of my mind as I read this extraordinarily detailed account of a life lived over a millennium ago. To what degree should I accede to Jin's narrative line as an accurate template and not a superimposed trope for the life of a misunderstood artist? I don't mean to question his methods or authority. He spent years culling foundational materials to create this elaborately detailed tapestry, materials I have neither the time nor the inclination or most likely even the opportunity to review. Jin is a fastidious, meticulous, and consummate professional in that regard. This has more to do with how individual human lives are made sense of from the outside in and the degree to which that sense accords with how they are made sense of from the inside out. My prior experience with Bai's work was exclusively through his poetry. He's one of my favorite poets. I'd read a lot of his poems with care and enjoyment, even wrote a book of my own that is a poetic conversation between us. On that basis, I concocted my own Li Bai, one with a foot clearly planted in the heaven he refers to repeatedly in his poems, often via the figure of the Star River, the Milky Way. Jin focuses more on the other foot, planted firmly in the real world of professional ambition, marriage, family, etc., all of which has the stereotypically troubled aspect that characterizes so many human lives when viewed in retrospect. As I explained above, Jin overlays a distinct pattern over Bai's life, one with many consecutive iterations. He works his way into a relationship or situation that might lead to his desired goal, a position or commission in the hierarchy of power in his moment. Then either by arrogance or bad judgment or the built-in duplicity of the social order or simply the vanity and stupidity of those empowered to facilitate his advancement, it all comes a cropper. My Bai's lifeline, built up on the basis of his poetry, seemed both much less orderly in its sequences and much more consistent emotionally. He had such a deep relationship with the natural world, for example, the material source for his imagery, a primal matrix of the highest order, inside and outside, merging in the most heartfelt ways. He is, yes, afflicted by loss, but more often the kind that arises from love than from ambition. To me, he had a genius, not for the exaggerated display that might advance a career, but for creating intimate images that almost anyone can relate to. Though Jin makes clear, he did a lot of the former as well. So which of these is more accurate? Well, of course, both are essential for understanding who Bai was and where he placed his faith. And there may be many other angles of entry as well. Every human life, no no matter how far off the grid it has lived. And Bob was eternally in motion, chronically itinerant, always seeking his next opportunity, until his final years, spent in contemplative seclusion, still takes place in this world, locked intimately into the fabric of its particular historical moment and its particular cultural context. It seems that Bai had his feet equally balanced between the diurnal scrum of power politics and the eternal heaven of his imagination, both of which he experienced on a grand scale, the former as a series of chronic failures, the latter as an array of spectacular successes, at least in his afterlife. His most famous poem is short, simple, and incomparably beautiful, one that Chinese children learn in elementary school, written in a moment of great despair, as Jin says, ill, destitute, and stranded, about to be evicted from his room, unable to contact a friend for help. As Jin goes on to explain, one night, unable to sleep, he watched the moonlit sky out the window for a long time and composed this poem. Moonlight spreads before my bed. I wonder if it's hoarfrost on the ground. I raise my head and watch the moon, and lowering it, I think of home. The moon, the dazzling round, the head lifted up and then down, heaven and earth together, here and now, now and then, one foot in each realm, perfectly balanced in four lines. The poem may sound kind of bland translated into English, which stretches images into phrases and sentences. In Chinese, each line has five characters, spoken with a single, strong syllable, sounding more like beating a drum than the phrasings of a piccolo. Magnificent. So where does this get me in this argument? Well, for one thing, I'd say if you want to know what anyone's primal matrix might be, listen to what they say or write closely and carefully. It will reveal itself in time. For those already past, there are only the documents they leave behind, breadcrumb trails to follow carefully, hopefully. Poetry happens to be the literary genre best suited for rendering that aspect of human experience, the primal matrix part, a great gift to a biographer. Jin quotes and comments on a lot of poems in his book, but given his genre here, they become either illustrations for or evidence in support of the overriding narrative line that he prefers for organizing sequences in Bai's life. I wish he had read the poems more intimately, trusted them more than what others had to say about Bai. But that is not his job. It is mine. Not surprisingly, Bai's poetry was considerably undervalued during his own time. He was justifiably frustrated by this reception, a not uncommon experience for great artists. Jin recounts one particular example of this, his encounter with a popular poetry anthology compiled by the influential Tang Dynasty critic Yin Fan, a two-volume set available for study to this day. Bai, he says, was pleased to find himself included, but was disconcerted to see his 13 poems outnumbered by poets he considered much inferior. Or still, in the commentary, Yin remarked on Li Bai's work with reservations, saying, like his personality, lacking in restraint, his style is self-indulgent. Bai's abundant ego resented this dismissive gesture, until he noticed that his friend Du Fu was not in the anthology at all. Du Fu, whose reputation is matched by his in the meantime, was almost entirely ignored in his time. And, not surprisingly, he's left a similar trail of failures in his attempts to procure a professional appointment. That's one thread of my thinking about this. The chronic incapacity of human society to recognize artistic greatness in its own time. A parsimony, rooted in the general resistance to rewarding the foot planted in heaven, always a threat to the status quo, instead of the one planted on earth. Some radical poets, like William Blake and Walt Whitman, persist and survive with modest recognition. Others, like Emily Dickinson and H.D., remain either entirely invisible or way under the radar during their own lifetimes. There are exceptions, of course, like William Wordsworth or T.S. Eliot. But there are many nameless others, I am sure, who never achieve any acclaim at all, either in their own time or in our histories. The other has to do with the conundrum I allude to above, the almost inevitable friction that characterizes a lived life, one's personal desires or ambitions abrading against the cultural norms of the immediate historical, cultural, social moment. For most, the latter wears down the former until it fits, personal vision meshing with established norms, leading to success, even fame, or just to normalcy, a settling into relative comfort. For creative figures generally out of kilter with their historical moment, the former grinds away at the latter, leading to frustration, even duress. The interesting thing to me about Li Bai, especially if I add my poetry-based narrative line to Jin's, is that he lived on both sides of this frictional surface, penalized while he lived, apotheosized only after he died. An irresistible force, straining always against an immovable object until, with his passing, there was only one foot left planted, the one in the heaven of his poems. Immediately after the passage I quote in section one, about Bai being caught between two incommensurable worlds and thereby feeling he had wasted his life, Jin says, "However, Bai's conflicting pursuits stem from the same thing, his awareness of his limited lifespan as a human being. Wealth and fame would maximize his experiences, while Taoism was a way to extend his time on earth. Both of his pursuits produced only pain and loneliness." I'd add to that last sentence that they also produced poetry of the highest order, which became, in my view, the means by which he entered an entirely different kind of heaven, one that surpasses the pain and loneliness Jin proposes. And this is my connection, via his poetic heaven, to the kingdom of heaven, to the primal matrix, and to the most precious sort of liberty one can find in a world that both celebrates it occasionally and undermines it almost always. All of this is simply to say that there are many routes available to rise above the infernal oppressions of our historical moment. What these authors share in common is a profound and hard-earned distrust for externally imposed, state-sponsored orthodoxies in relation to imperialistic ambitions, priestly elites, or autocratic political dynasties, designed to enforce social order at the expense of the masses, whether native inhabitants, churchgoers, workers, poets, or thinking folks just trying to get by.